everyone. Welcome to the Time Shifters Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Page. There is a genre of film out there that I have only just scratched the surface on, and I've been really enjoying it. And in no small part, due to a podcast I started listening to a while back called The Nashi Cast. Now, the genre is Spanish horror. And I figured, you know, I still had questions about it. I thought the best way to do it is go straight to the source. So I went to the hosts of the Nashi Cast, Rod Burnett and Troy Gwynn, and I have them with me right now. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Nice to have you invite us.
I actually got a chance to meet you guys in person at the recent Monster Bash, and that was a big thrill.
Oh, man. Great time. That was a great weekend.
Always great fun at the Monster Bash.
Yeah, that was a good time. I know that was the first time you guys had been back in a few years, wasn't it? And it was only my second, so...
Yeah, for me, it was about the first time in, I think, about 6 years. Normally, for me, it's hard to do because it's so close to G-Fest. And me, also being a major Godzilla geek, I can't miss the Godzilla convention in Chicago. And both Monster Bash and G-Fest, are the kind of conventions where you can spend a little bit of money if you if you really, really try really hard.
I have no idea what you mean.
So, but, you know, screw it. This year, I decided I was going to treat myself. It had been too long since I'd been to Monster Bash in Pittsburgh there, and so I went
Plus,
back.
It's been a long time since Troy's been really, really in debt. So
I miss that feeling, man. So, and then Rod, that's probably your first time in a couple of years, right?
It was my first time in, I think, either 4 or 5
okay,
years.
So
yeah, I think four years, five years, something along in there. Mm-hmm. We've been doing the Nashi Cast for maybe 2 years, so maybe it was 4 years ago.
Yeah,
we've been doing the podcast for a little while, and I went up there with another buddy of ours, one of our podcasting buddies, Jeff Nelson, the guy who does the artwork for our podcast as well. And if I had my druthers, I'd go every year.
Same here.
But it's you know, it's always a money question and a time question. And some years it's impossible. Some years you luck out.
And what's one of the really nice things about it was that the whole thing of being able to, now that we've done this podcast for a few years, is being able to put faces to names of people that we've met through the podcasting community and been, you know, friends with on Facebook and all that, and then to get to actually meet people in person, you know, was really fun.
It was a real shock at Monster Bash to have people hear Troy's voice, recognize him from his voice, and come up to him and know who he was.
Yeah, that really threw me. That was funny because I'm just walking in the dealer's room talking to somebody, and these couple of guys just come up and say you're one of the Nashi Cast hosts, aren't you? You know, and they literally strictly just by hearing my voice realized that it was me. So that was pretty funny.
Yeah, I was a witness to that.
Yeah.
That is awesome. Yeah, you know, the podcast community, that's one of the things I've enjoyed most since I started doing these things, is meeting these people. You know, started listening to podcasts for one thing, and then getting a chance to meet the people that actually do the shows, and then actually be able to do shows myself, and then other podcasters, you know, go ahead and they listen to my show, and I listen to their show, and it just becomes a sort of weird family.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe slightly dysfunctional, probably less dysfunctional than most actual families.
Probably so, yeah.
But one thing you do find out very quickly is that no matter what your subject matter is, there are people who will listen, which was something that was a real revelation to me, was how many people actually listened to I didn't think anybody would listen to our podcast when we were first going to start doing it.
Neither of us did.
But I have a really good friend who, this is an example, a few years ago, he started getting into... first he learned blacksmithing and learned, he worked on, you know, learned how to shoe horses and that sort of thing, put shoes on horses. And then he eventually got into natural hoof care, which is where you care for horses' hooves, you know, without actually putting horseshoes on them, and got into that. And eventually he tells me that, hey, man, I'm going to be guesting on a podcast for natural hoof care, you know. And I was like, repeat that? And he said, I'm going to be on a podcast for natural hoof care. And I thought, well, that proves it right there, man. There is a podcast for every single subject you could possibly be interested in.
And we had listeners and an audience for it.
And a community, yeah.
Yeah, that means there's a community out there of people who want to hear this podcast and are waiting for the next episode.
All right, well, let's get into the Nashi Cast a little bit. First, I was curious, were you guys friends before the cast? How did you guys meet or get together to do the podcast in the first place? And then I want to know why Nashi? Why in particular. Why Spanish horror is one of the things I want to get to, and then why Nashi in particular.
Well, we met at the center of the universe. Tell them about that, Rod, and how that happened.
Okay, we had a friend that Troy knew long before I did, but I got to know this particular fellow. His name was Jack Daves, and he kind of held court. He had an apartment that he shared with various people at different times, including Troy, mm-hmm. that in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And that is, if you don't know, near a college, which means that you have, let's just say, a large conglomeration of people of various types and interests.
With a lot of time on their hands.
With a lot of time on their hands.
And they like to party.
Yes. The desire to drink beer and to watch movies and to do strange and interesting things that have absolutely nothing to do with learning anything. Mm-hmm. So I knew Jack through a couple of other friends, and that's how Troy and I met. I'm assuming it was around 1990, but we referred to wherever Jack was, particularly one particular couple of apartments he had at a certain time in the late 80s, early 90s, as the center of the universe, because it seemed that if you sat there, much like a river, eventually everyone would fly by. So.
And actually, the apartments were right next to. There was an actual marker. They refer to this area that we live in, Nashville, Murfreesboro, as Middle Tennessee. There's actually a marker in Murfreesboro that designates it that this is the exact center of Tennessee, and our apartment was just right. Our apartment complex was right next to it. So again, that also led to us calling it the center of the universe. But like Rod said, really, it was more to do with it. Jack, everybody hovered around Jack. The man knew everybody. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, one of my early times that I went to Monster Bash, I was up there and I was standing in the hotel lobby talking to Rod and some other people. And this guy came up and just by my accent, he came up. He said, "Do you by any chance know Jack Daves?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I just guessed it because you sound like you're from the South, and I've been in contact with Jack. He's been helping me make a documentary, or he's been giving me advice on making a documentary about horror hosts." And so, just from the fact that he guessed I was from the South, he figured I must know Jack. So that's where we sort of just became part of this apartment, just this never-ending, cast of characters that came and went in Jack's apartment, sat and watched movies and just talked movies and just hung out. And
that's a lot of discussions about movies, a lot of back and forth. Why do you enjoy this? Why didn't you enjoy this? And just kind of not necessarily butting heads, but kind of sharpening your verbal skills and your descriptions of why you enjoyed or didn't enjoy a film or a book or whatever was the topic of discussion. And it became a kind of home away from home for more than a few of us.
And if we sound like we're talking about Jack in the past tense, it's because he passed away in 2004 and very, very much missed. Incredible man, just truly, truly an amazing mind, great wit, and was sort of just one of those people that's into everything and knows about everything and is very happy to share and to have other people share what they're into with him. So it was really great to know him.
But to your point about Paul Nashi, one of the things is that I spent the 90s kind of reaching out and learning more and more about different strains of kind of cult horror simply because I could, because more and more I had more and more contacts. You know, once you're in college and once you're around a lot of different people, you start going to conventions and things of that nature, and you start running across the really obscure stuff that isn't necessarily shown on television, that you've never heard of in your life, and that just looks really, really interesting. And so that's when I started getting interested in the Eurocult stuff and, you know, the stuff from Italy and Spain and England that I just never heard of. And Troy, luckily, was, well, Jack was as well, but Troy was definitely into this stuff. And Paul Nashi is just one of the subjects that I knew I wanted to know more of because I had read some in fanzines and in different movie magazines, and I knew just a little bit, but I had never delved into the subject of Paul Nashi and his films. But Troy had seen a number of them on television growing up and had managed to get a few of them on videotape from different sources.
Yeah, it was kind of that whole great boom of bootleg, you know, where you could like get Psychotronic magazine and things like that, Film Threat and all that, and order
Sinister Cinema,
yeah, and order like bootleg tapes. And so I started looking for Nashi titles and getting them that way.
So he would loan me the a few of them, but this was only after I had run across a couple of them and rented them in a local mom and pop video store there in Murfreesboro where we were all living at the time. And So I saw The Werewolf and the Yeti under the title Night of the Howling Beast. And then he loaned me Horror Rises from the Tomb and a couple of the other werewolf movies. And I was off to the races because this was a whole new, completely bizarre field of horror movies and monster movies that I knew nothing about. But every time every time I cracked that window, something really fun seemed to be waiting on the other side. And even the crazier stuff. I mean, at the same time, I'm exploring, you know, all kinds of stuff. I was buying really expensive bootleg videotapes through the mail and things like that. I mean, so at the same time, I'm discovering things like Meet the Feebles and Brain Dead. I'm also discovering Dario Argento's movies, Mario Bava's films, all kinds of things of that nature. And Paul Naschy was just part of it.
Yeah. And so you flash forward to the podcast, you know, the whole podcasting thing begins. And, all of us had started listening to podcasts and telling each other, hey, check out this podcast, like B-Movie Cast, Gentleman's Guide to the Cinema and things like that. And we kept, we'd say, hey, I found this great podcast, guys talking about movies. And it had been floated out among our group of friends every now and then and say, like, man, you know, we all know so much about films and love talking about them so much. And we're so frightfully witty. Why don't
we? We're so damn funny.
So erudite and whatever. But anyway, that we should do a podcast. But it really kind of took Rod to float out the idea of just one time say, like, man, would you be interested in doing a one on Paul Naschy? And that's when it kind of rung the bell. Like, okay, that's unique enough that it's worth, you know, that for me personally to devote the time make the time to do that. I thought, yeah, that's something I would be excited about doing. And as I'm always fond of saying, you know, I was like, if we suck, it won't matter because no one will hear it. So, yeah. And we truly had we didn't know what first episode. We had no idea what we were going to do. We just hit the record and we just hit the record.
We knew what film we were talking. We knew the format. We knew what we were going to do because the whole idea, what I wanted, the whole reason for the podcast in my mind was I wanted there to be a podcast about Paul Naschy. As a matter of fact, I had done an extensive search across the internet thinking there must be one. And when I discovered there wasn't one, it was like, well, damn it. I guess somebody needs to make that. Yeah. And looked over in a mirror and there was my ugly mug staring back at me. And I realized, well, maybe it should be me.
And to do it, and to take him, to put some out there where that takes him seriously and conveys what we really, I think, ultimately want to convey is why his films are worth seeing, you know.
Right.
It's like we have fun with the film, sure, but at the end of the day, you know, we believed that there's artistic value there. They deserve to be
seen. And these films in our eyes have merit, and what we wanted to do and the tack we wanted to take was each episode is a single film. We're going to go through it scene by scene. We're going to pull it apart and see what makes it work for us and what doesn't work for us, and the good bits and the bits that are funny and the things that are idiosyncratic and the things that just don't make any damn sense. And the whole idea was spend an entire podcast deep diving into a single film all the way through, talk it to death, figure it out, and then see if anybody gives a crap.
You forgot expressing our admiration for the scores of women, beautiful Spanish women in these films.
Yes, we do that. We do that quite frequently. As a matter of fact, sometimes, quite honestly, I think we get distracted by some of the women in the movies. It was a really eye-opening experience after watching Helga Linnae in two different movies that we'd done Horror Rises from the Tomb. Mm-hmm. And then two episodes later, we did Vengeance of the Mummy. Mm-hmm. And Helga Linnae is in both of them. And she's just this gorgeous woman. And that's when I did enough research to realize that in Horror Rises from the Tomb, when she's doing all this nudity, the woman was 40 years old.
Yeah.
Which means that all the movies she made after that, she was creeping toward 50 and still doing nudity and still looked better than some of the 20 somethings on the screen at the same time. And that took about a week to just kind of sink in.
One, it seems like you guys really had a lot of practice with your group of friends that you had. It sounds like you guys were kind of almost, you know, auditioning or practicing for podcasting before podcasting existed.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, that's kind of true. I've thought a little bit about how, and this has kind of been a subject of conversation just this evening, actually, with somebody else that I occasionally do a podcast with, which is the idea that when I'm talking about a film with somebody, I want to dig into the reasons why that person enjoys the film and the reasons that person doesn't enjoy the film and where they fall. And I want to really dig into it because I want to know what their reactions stem from. I want to know why they care about this movie enough to talk about it in the first place, all the way down to why they didn't like the font used for the title sequence. You know, all this other stuff. And so when I meet people who actually are interested enough in film or in a particular movie to have those kind of discussions, man, that's awesome. That's like a three-course meal as far as I'm concerned, because now we're really digging into the things that make us respond to a piece of entertainment. And I think that I know for me, the podcasts that I listen to that I really enjoy a lot, and the ones that I go back to again and again and again, are the ones that do that kind of thing, where you're listening to some people dig into, why do I like this so much, or why do I not like this so much? And mm-hmm. You can do it with humor. You can do it with sarcasm. You can do it with a biting intelligence. You can do it with just whatever. You can do it with a complete exasperation that eventually leads you to suicide. I don't care. Just do it in a way that's entertaining, and we're good. I don't want to be in a discussion with somebody whose entire response to a movie is all right.
Right.
I mean, because then what do we have to talk about? If the movie wasn't that good and you don't want to talk about it, okay, great. But if your entire reaction to every movie you see is all right, well, then why are you bothering watching these things? Try a book, for God's sake, or I don't know, something possibly illegal. I don't know. Try something.
Well, you had a little bit of a head start on some of this, both with the group of friends you had, but didn't you already have a blog? Did your blog start before you started doing the podcast?
Oh, God, yeah. I started a blog simply because I desperately crave the attention of others. The blog I started, oh, man. I would actually have to go look at the blog. I can't remember. I think it was maybe around 2007. I felt a great void within my soul, and I decided to fill it by writing the occasional useless thing and throwing it up on the internet and see if anybody said anything. The blog has kind of taken on a life of its own, because now it's something that I feel an almost ridiculous obligation to keep alive, but it gives me so much joy to do so, I don't mind. I created a blog called The Bloody Pit of Rod, and that's kind of what all of this stemmed from in the first place, because without that blog, I don't really think that I'd have had the confidence to think that I could do this podcasting thing, because there's a big leap from enjoying listening to podcasts to deciding that you can do this stuff as well. And having actually floated, having spent a few years writing movie reviews for a particular website that no longer exists, and writing pieces that, you know, no one was editing me at all on the blog, so I could kind of, you know, freeform the way I wanted to and put things out the way I felt. And that kind of thing seemed like the first step toward doing a podcast. But of course, that's definitely not true for everybody, because they're very different things. But it all goes back for me anyway to starting the blog and realizing that it felt pretty good to kind of, in a bizarre way, get this stuff off my chest, or get these ideas out there, or send up a flag and see who saluted it to a large degree, which is essentially what a blog kind of is for me. And if you go to the Bloody Pit of Rod, you can, you know, there's links on the right side of the page to the NashyCast and the podcast that I eventually started out of that, just called The Bloody Pit. They all stem from that. I do still occasionally write way too long pieces that go onto the blog where I go into just ridiculous detail about something that probably no one else will respond to. And then I post up great poster art from the past. But it all depends on the mood of the day, what I'm interested in. Sometimes I'll write about comic books. You just got to be prepared.
And actually, we should mention, too, that the Bloody Pit podcast that's the one that's really more of an open-ended that you do. Basically, you set up to where you could talk about anything you wanted to, although so far it's pretty much been movies or television. I mean, I don't think you've yet done one about either like books or comics, have you? Or have you?
About books or comics, although I have done a couple of episodes.
You've done like a radio show or audio show.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a big fan of old horror radio as well. So one of the things, I've done a couple of episodes that have focused in on some old time radio characters and things like that. I did an episode where I examined Vincent Price's film Diary of a Madman and two different old radio adaptations of the same story. Mm-hmm. And that was fun. And I may do things like that in the future as well, but you know, with podcasting, especially when you're doing those occasional podcasts that I'm doing without somebody else there to rein me in or to give focus to whatever is running through my head, it becomes something of a heavy lift when you occasionally do an episode of a podcast completely on your own. That's pretty difficult. If I don't have somebody like Troy, who's smart and who's contemplative and who's actually thought about the subject at hand to kind of bounce my ideas off of, I end up kind of throwing my ideas out there and not knowing what to do next. So.
Yeah, I've tried to do the solo review before on some things, and it is extremely difficult. You really need that interplay with other people. At least I do, and it sounds like you do as well.
Yeah.
I know there are people out there that can have essentially have a conversation with themselves, and it's interesting, and they come up with these great points, and it's like, oh, well, okay, wow. I am not one of them. I need somebody else to go, no, you're wrong, or I agree, anything other than just silence.
Yeah,
on the other end.
The best at it, I think, is still Terry Frost down in Australia. I think his two podcasts, Paleo Cinema and Martian Drive-In, are really the only two solitary, single-person podcasts that I can listen to and not feel like I'm listening to someone babble into a mirror. He's really good at it.
I don't think I've checked either one of those out, but maybe I'll have to.
Oh, I highly recommend both of them. Paleo Cinema focuses more on basically everything but science fiction, horror, and fantasy, and Martian Drive-In focuses just on that.
So gotcha.
Both of them are fantastic shows, and he's one of the few people out there who I can listen to for an hour talk about a couple of movies and not feel like I don't get bored with him.
Well, let's get back into a little bit more into the Spanish Order and Paul Naschy. What was the film that you saw that made you say, I need to see more of this guy? And we should mention Paul Naschy is both an actor and a director. Yes.
Oh, and yes, a writer.
And writer. Okay.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, most of his monster movies from the golden era, from the 70s, he wrote pretty much all of them.
Okay.
Well,
what was it?
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, for me, I guess I'll start since I guess I was into him a little bit before Rod, because I did get to see some of these films at a pretty young age. Now, the first couple of Paul Naschy films I saw, I didn't automatically connect the two as being films that were, written and starring the same guy, because one was the first time I encountered him was I caught the last 30 minutes of Frankenstein's Bloody Terror on a local television station here. It was Channel 17 that was an amazing channel for filling in so many of the horror films and science fiction films I'd read about and famous monsters growing up, but didn't get to see in my first, when I was, under 10 or whatever. I would see some, I saw films, of course, horror movies and things, but there was a lot that never got shown. And when Channel 17 came along, they started showing the occasional Euro horror film. So Frankenstein's Bloody Terror, I saw listed in the paper, turned it on, caught the last 30 minutes of it. Was wondering where Frankenstein's monster was, but at the same time, I was thinking, oh, cool, there's a werewolf and a vampire here, And I was like, man, I wish I'd seen that whole film because it looked like it was a great film. My older brother had seen a film that he had caught a film one night on Channel 17 called Horror Rises from the Tomb that he just raved about, that he said it was unlike anything he had seen before, and wanted me to catch it the next time it came around, and I got to see a little bit of it the next time it came around, and certainly I could see totally what he was talking about, that the feel of it was something that was just really otherworldly and unlike what I was used to, which was basically the British or the Universal films. There were Hammer films or Universal films. I kind of feel this was something totally different. Still didn't necessarily connect that it was anything to do with featuring the same actor or whatever. So what really kind of clicked Paul Naschy in my head, a book that I've mentioned several times on the podcast. To me, it's still the greatest reference book on horror films that I've ever encountered. And it was first called The Encyclopedia of Horror Films. And it was edited by Phil Hardy. And it came out in 1986. Amazing, comprehensive reference book to horror movies. And it's the first book I ever came across that actually acknowledged and all world cinema. It was the first place that I read about Jean Roland. Now, I had actually come across a couple of Fulci films before this book came out, but it was probably the first place that I became aware of Mario Bava, although I'd seen Black Sunday growing up. I'd loved Black Sunday, but at first where I found out who made that film, all these other films he made, first time I saw Coffin Joe mentioned, you know, Jose Marans and the Coffin Joe films, and I started to see so many of these write-ups about all these films starring this guy, you know, who went by the names Jacinto Molina and Paul Naschy. And as soon as I read about, you know, Frankenstein's Bloody Terror, Horror Rises from the Tomb, it started to connect the dots. And that's kind of what made me start looking for his name, you know, start looking to seek his. Just to let you know, you can still find this Phil Hardy book out there, actually used copies for not too bad. It came out again in 1995 in an updated version. It's called The Overlooked Guide to Horror Films. Has never been updated since, unfortunately, but that still was kind of like the Bible for me as far as starting to seek these things out in that kind of that magical time when, again, like I mentioned before, the bootleg horror market, horror VHS bootleg film market started popping up, Video Search of Miami and all those places. I started scouring these magazines for, and I started looking at the, like Rod mentioned, being able to actually rent a couple of his films at video stores. Probably the first film that I saw that I knew that was a Paul Naschy film and I was watching for him was they also showed on local television here. They showed Count Dracula's Great Love. And that's probably the first one that I saw on TV where I knew who he was and kind of what his began to get a sense of that he was. Oh, this is if nothing else, I was thinking this is a Spanish version of the horror stories that I grew up loving. Bela Lugosi, Boris Karloff, that sort of thing. And at a Blockbuster video, I was able to rent House of Psychotic Women and also Night of the Werewolf under the title of The Craving. But then most of the other stuff I started just getting, through the, just finding the bootleg, you know, just wherever I could see his name. So that's kind of what kicked me off on being aware of who he was.
Well, for me, I read about Paul Naschy long before I ever saw one of his films because, I'm kind of an obsessive reader of movie magazines and film reference books and things like that. And I would read references to his films or even reviews, little capsule reviews of certain of his films. And I was just like, okay, I've got to see this stuff. I've got to eventually see this stuff one way or another. But at the time I'm reading these things, it's the late 80s, right at the beginning of the early 90s. And, you know, if it's not shown on television or somebody hasn't put it out on videotape and you know how to track it down under some obscure title somewhere that you have no reference for, you're not going to find it. So the first one I ever saw was Night of the Howling Beasts, also known as The Werewolf and the Yeti, that I did rent from that mom and pop video store there in Murfreesboro. And it was the first one I got to see. And it was like lightning struck me in the head because it really is unlike anything that I had seen up to that point. And even a lot of the Eurocult stuff that I was seeing at the time, it didn't really line up aesthetically in a lot of ways. It was this weird thing because one thing you'll learn if you watch a few Paul Naschy films, his driving force is the monster movie. Yes, they're horror movies, but first and foremost, they really are about monsters. And his monster of choice is the werewolf, and there's a reoccurring character that I've taken to over the years referring to as the Doctor Who werewolf because you never know where he's going to turn up and what age and what exactly his personality is going to be. But essentially, the idea that he loved the werewolf, and there's a lot of reasons for that because he's the most tortured of the monsters. If you watch the Lon Chaney Wolfman movies, you know that this is a guy who is a monster and desperately does not want to be what he is. It's not like Dracula, who kind of revels in the joys of his undead life. He does not want to be a werewolf. He does not want to be this ravening beast who uncontrollably murders.
And Paul Naschy is very good at conveying a certain like vulnerability, tortured personality. I mean, he definitely kind of, I think, tried to channel that Lon Chaney Jr. sort of aura of tragedy about him that Chaney Jr. was able to do in his werewolf films. And I think Naschy kind of tried to convey that too and did a really good job of it in his werewolf films.
But the thing is, after I saw Werewolf and the Yeti or Night of the Howling Beast, the next one that I remember seeing that just fried my mind was Horror Rises from the Tomb, which in a lot of ways, it's almost always my fallback, you know, best of Naschy horror film, because there's a bizarre feel that the entire movie has that almost has to be experienced. I've never found a good way to describe it other than to just go through and point out how atmospheric it is and how it's a movie that has its own creep factor kind of built into almost every scene. Famously, Nashi wrote it, and famously he wrote it staying up several days straight in a, you know, essentially probably taking speed to keep himself awake to write the whole screenplay because he desperately needed the screenplay written as quickly as possible. And the thing is, you'd think with a movie that he completely admitted that's how he wrote the thing, you'd think it would be this incoherent mess that doesn't add up and doesn't make sense. But what it is this bizarre mess of very strange elements that somehow or another through the alchemy of cinema actually work together. And it has some truly bizarre things in it. It has some things that I've never seen in another movie. It has elements, and this is true of a lot of Nashi's films. His take on this stuff was certainly unique. Now, understand at the time in the 90s when I'm, you know, delving into this stuff and trying to see as much of it as I can, I'm also eating a complete diet of Eurotrash. Every kind of Eurotrash I can get my hands on. And so I'm watching and rewatching Lucio Fulci gore films and every giallo I can get my hands on and just, you know, laying waste to whatever Eurocult weirdness is available. And so this was at the time just another, the Paul Nashi films were just a subset of that kind of joy, but one that always stood apart because they weren't really a part of it and they never felt the same. As atmospheric and strange and interesting as a Bava film is, and I love all of them, there's a very different feel to a Paul Nashi movie. And a lot of that just goes back to the fact that he's primarily making monster movies.
And I think maybe that there's a passion that comes through his filmmaking that maybe doesn't mm-hmm. come through some of the other these other people we mentioned who are maybe more technically proficient that are making technically
better films.
But Nashi, I think that love for the subject, it's, you know, truly comes out in what he's doing. And I've likened Horror Rises from the Tomb. And I do think it's one of the greatest, too, of all Spanish horror films. And I've likened it to something else I have a great love for, which are some of the horror magazines, comic magazines of the early 70s that were coming out.
The black and white.
The black and white horror magazines, which, you know, Marvel was doing and Eerie Publications, of course, Warren magazines. But the ones I specifically think of are the Skywald magazines, Nightmare and Psycho and Scream. The Skywald magazines funnily enough, also many of their artists were Spanish artists. And I think that's really what a lot of the connection is. I think they were kind of going through the same cultural having the same cultural references that Paul Nashi did. And these magazines were just so bizarre and kind of psychedelic, taking supernatural, taking all the horror tropes, we always know vampires and werewolves and all that sort of thing, Frankenstein, but channeling through this really, very modern, grisly, you know, sexual gore channel too. Yeah. That was just an incredible match. I think Horror Rises from the Tomb is one of the the film that I always think of that most closely evokes those same those magazines that I loved. And I think that's one of the things that drew me to it. It's like it stepped right. It's like it sprung out of one of those Skywalk magazines.
Yeah, very cool. That's a film that I've been looking for. Haven't been able to find really get my hands on a copy. That's one of the things. Like I said, I was only just now kind of scratching the surface on some of these Euro cinema, Euro horror films. And I've probably seen the least amount of any of it. It is probably the Nashi films. I haven't seen all that much. And I keep hearing that title come up. And I think, oh, well, I'll go try to find it. And it's rather difficult to get one's hands on.
I would have, well, you know, and I haven't looked for it in a long time now. It's actually one of the ones that's had one of the nicer DVD releases. Unfortunately, it's long out of print. And as he's getting more popular, those copies are starting to disappear out there and are starting to become more pricier or harder to find. I keep hoping that, you know, because it's one of his most popular titles, that we're maybe not too far off from an eventual Blu-ray release, fingers crossed, but who knows, you know. But yeah, I can see how right now that one might actually have gone down into the lower depths, you know, as far as you can find. Yep. So, and it's a shame because it is, that's the one that I would, you know, I mean, that's the one that's probably still my favorite of all of his films. And I would probably definitely one of the first ones that I would recommend. If not the first, it's one of the, you know, if I was going to recommend two or three to somebody, hey, here's what you start with. That one's always going to be there because, it's just a fantastic film.
That's a good idea. I mean, just to give him a heads up on Nashi, what would be the three or four or five Nashi films that, you know, we'd point him toward as the ones to seek out to get a taste of kind of the best of what he's capable of?
Well, I think you got to go with Werewolf Shadow, not just because it's a good film, which it is. Werewolf Shadow, which is also found under the title of Werewolf versus the Vampire Women, not only because it's I think it is, one of his best, but I think it's probably the most important to his career really overall. And it's very important, not just upon Nashi's career, but if you're delving into Spanish horror, it's an incredibly important title in the history of Spanish horror because it's the film that really kicked off a boom of Spanish horror production in the early 70s because it was so successful in the all around the world, but also especially the market that's always the most important. It was the U.S. at that time, the U.S. drive-in circuit, the U.S. exploitation circuit. It actually did very well, and that's the one that, it wasn't Paul Nashi's first werewolf film, but it's the one that really kind of established him as sort of beginning, sort of an international horror star as much as a Spanish actor could be. Again, just basically having his film shown on the drive-in circuit. So I would say Werewolf Shadow, A Horror Rises from the Tomb. I would say probably House of Psychotic Women. If you want to see Nashi doing more of what in a taking his shot at a giallo, a non-supernatural story, and basically all based on human characters, that's one that I think is a really good early one to watch.
House of Psychotic Women,
which is also called Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll.
Right. Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll is the title, and it's most it's probably easier to find it under these days because along with Horror Rises from the Tomb, it's one that got a decent DVD release about 10 years ago.
And I think you probably have to watch the first one, The Frankenstein's Bloody Terror.
Or the title I wish it were better known under, which is Mark of the Wolfman.
Right. That's the actual title that he made it under. So that's four right there. So we still need a fifth one.
I'd go with Night of the Werewolf.
Actually, Night of the Werewolf was an early 80s or maybe right at 1980. Anyway, it's Paul Nashi's own remake of Werewolf Shadow. Werewolf Shadow was written by Nashi, but it was made by Leon Klimovsky, who's a very good Spanish director. In his films, we've covered several of his films, but
we've covered a lot of his films.
Yeah. But Nashi actually remade Werewolf Shadow as Night of the Werewolf, and that's the film that I mentioned was also under the title of The Craving, although that was fairly cut version. But that's interesting because those two films stand, even though they tell essentially the same story, they're different enough that it's not repetitive to watch one after the other. It's actually really interesting to compare them because they're both very good films, very different films. So yeah, that would be a good handful right there. That's a good five to start with there. Yeah. So yeah.
And of course, I would always throw in Vengeance of the Mummy just to irritate Troy.
Actually, I do. Yeah, we have this continuing. I'm not a huge fan per se of the mummy monster, the archetype, whatever, or mummy films. However, I will say Vengeance of the Mummy. If I were going to rank mummy films, I will say that it is one of the better ones. So yeah,
it's definitely fantastic.
And now, eventually once you've devoured a handful of Nashi films and think you know him, that's when we would spring something like El Comandante.
Yeah. The things that over the course of the podcast have shocked us have been of such high quality that, well, don't get me wrong, there have been a few that have shocked us because, my God, they've been terrible.
Yeah.
Those have mostly been the comedies that he attempted because, my God, they're terrible. But yeah, there were a couple of really strong discoveries as we got into delving really deeply into the movies that he made in the late 70s after the horror boom had kind of busted that are in some ways kind of personal films and also just really, really good. El Comandante, also known as the translation would be The Traveler, would be a film that I could easily see Criterion putting in. It's a phenomenal movie.
Well, I made the statement when we did the podcast, I made the statement that if this film had come out with Fellini or Pasolini's name on it, the critics would be creaming themselves over it. It would be, yeah. So, we forgot to Hunchback of the Morgue. I don't have the list of my films in front of me. Hunchback of the Morgue is another one you got to check out.
Is an amazing film. And it's very lucky that Hunchback of the Morgue is one of the few films that we actually have a Paul Nashi commentary track on. He did a commentary track with the director of the film on a DVD release of it that came out. Well, once again, I'm going to have to say like 8, 9, 10 years ago.
Right.
That I'm not even sure if it's still in print. But the film itself, no matter how you see it, is an amazing piece of work because Paul Naschy plays a hunchback character who is a little on the slow side, but also unfortunately a little murderous, and still manages to, while being the hunchback in the story, still manages to have two gorgeous women fall in love with him. That's what happens when you write the screenplay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Actually, you know, we should point out he was not a stupid man. He when he directed and wrote, he always made sure that his character was sort of the apple of all the women's eyes in the film. And in fact, one of our listeners gave us the greatest name for it. They call it the Naschy Musk. Is what they call it. The Naschy, when the Naschy Musk gets turned on, no woman is safe from it. And yeah, I remember my older brother watching the film. Yeah, he made the comment. He said only Paul Naschy could play a hunchback and still get laid by the most beautiful woman in the film. So yeah.
Well, the Hunchback of the Morgue is really a fantastic one. And yeah, that really kind of needs to be in that
must list of the first. Yes, definitely.
But
very, very cool. I'm glad to actually have like a handful of films to really kind of focus on, because I'm looking at his filmography, which just stretches through pages and pages online. And it's nice to know that I kind of have this handful that I can kind of try to zero in on a little bit.
There's some real gems in there, not just the ones that we're talking about now. Some of them you'll run across and think, oh, well, let's just see if what this is. And it'll come at you in a surprising way. But that's mm-hmm. that's true of a lot of European films of the 70s in the first place, where you're never really sure exactly what you're going to get. And sometimes, sometimes it's chalk and sometimes it's cheese.
Right. Well, I think, like I said, I'm scratching the surface now. I think my gateway was like many people when they're crossing the pond into the films. They start with like the Hammer and the Amicus films.
Sure. Yeah.
And then you move a little further overseas, and then you get into some of the Italian cinema and the Spanish cinema. And I've been enjoying just about everything I've seen, because if you kind of keep a wide net, you can find a lot of the stuff fairly inexpensively, whether it be bootleg or online or even just legitimate releases, but now they're $10 on Amazon or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think, thanks to podcasts like yours and a few others, that's where I've been getting a lot of these titles from. I listen to these podcasts and you guys go through the plots and I start making notes. Okay, need to see this one, need to see this one. It was the B Movie Cast that covered the first Tombs of the Blind Dead.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, this sounds like something I need to see. Well, the Walmart had it online, the big coffin box set, for I don't know, it was like $20.
Cool.
I'm like, well, yeah, I'll get that.
That's a good deal. I think I paid 40 when it came out. So
yeah. And so I got all those, and so I just enjoyed the hell out of those. I think we talked a little bit about that at Monster Bash, Rod, talking about that, those collection of films.
Well, the Blind Dead films, all four of them, although I have serious problems with Ghost Galleon, the third one.
Yeah.
As do I.
as do most people. But
it's a bit of a sleeper.
It's got a great ending. You got to hand it that. That ending is creepy as hell.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's the first Blind Dead film that I saw. It's the only one that I saw, had seen, excuse me, before I actually saw them referred to as a group of films through the same source I mentioned earlier, the book by Phil Hardy, The Encyclopedia of Horror Films. I had actually, that's another one where I was able to connect the dots. I kept saw these write-ups about all these Blind Dead films, but I realized that the one that I had not liked the one that I had seen. I had actually found it. I guess it was Horror. Is that, because that's the one that's also called Horror of the Zombies, geez. Right?
Yeah, I believe that's the title.
So I rented it from Blockbuster and found it just, a sleeper, to use the great term there, and found it, not real impressed. But then when I was reading these reviews in this book, and it talked about how haunting this shots of the zombies riding their horses, and I thought, well, that wasn't in the film that I saw. So that's what made me decide to give these other ones a chance, and cycled back around to them. And yeah, I would pretty much say that I enjoy all of them except for Ghost Galleon. And I'm sure we can go ahead and mention now, as we're branching out beyond Paul Naschy, that we do have a show called Beyond Naschy. It's actually part of the Naschy cast, but we occasionally as a chance to go ahead and cover other Spanish films as our sort of our theme. We call it Beyond Nashi because what will most any Spanish horror film you pick up from the 70s is going to have at least a couple of people that you also saw in a lot of Nashi films. And so we just say like we call it the Nashiverse, you know. We'll just say like well, this film features, you know, these actors or this director that also worked with Paul Nashi. It's like that 6 degrees of separation kind of thing. And so we've covered the first two Blind Dead films, which means the next time we decide to do one, it's going to be Ghost Galley. So that'll be that'll probably be my first watch of it since that first time I saw it. And so,
wow, really? You haven't seen it?
Yeah, so we're talking maybe 30, 40 years separation will give me a chance to watch it again under new eyes.
Let me take some of the sting out of the thought of covering Ghost Galley eventually, which we obviously probably will. When you go back to watch it, you may find that it's not as horrible as your memory is built
to. That's what I'm because guessing.
Because the thing is, it's a long haul of that great ending. But along the way, there are joys. And there are there's some really strange stuff in there that doesn't need to be in there because it's an Amando D'Iassorio film.
Right.
And the man always seemed to have these odd thoughts that he's just going to cram into the story, whether it needed it or not. Plus, it has Jack Taylor.
I was just about to say nothing else. Now I'm, of course, very familiar with the awesome Jack Taylor, and so I will be, you know, happy to now and then when I do go to rewatch it, I'll be aware of that I'm going to be watching a Jack Taylor film. And I think I'd said before when we were talking about it, is which is more wooden, Jack or the ship?
Jack Taylor is one of those actors who he's an American actor who spent who has spent almost his entire career in Europe. Making a name for himself and obviously doing quite well. And he's in a number of Jess Franco films, Paul Nashi films, Amando D'Iassorio films. I honestly don't think there's a Euro cult filmmaker he didn't end up in a film for at one point or another. He's still alive, lives in Madrid. And one of the things about him is that he can sometimes be so painfully wooden in a film, so unemotive. And then you see him in another film, and he's freaking brilliant.
Yeah, he can be. Yeah, you know, there's some actors you can say they never phoned it in. You can't really say that about Jack Taylor.
Can't say that,
but when he's not phoning it in, he's quite good, very good.
Yeah. When he's on fire, he just lights the screen up, and you can't take your eyes off him. But man, sometimes.
You can tell the films that he liked the script. You can tell the films that he needed to pay the rent with. Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes I think that's so. I think one of the funnier moments we've ever had is we finally, because I desperately wanted to, we covered the 1980s horror film from Spain called Pieces, which was actually the very first European horror film I ever saw in my life. And I actually saw it in the theater when it came out. And Jack Taylor has a prominent role in that, and he emotes less in that than like a waterbed. I'm telling you, there's the occasional flutter of an emotion across his face, and that's about it. But what's weird is it's hard to tell if he knew Pieces was complete dog shit and just didn't want to play, or if when you see the movie and you realize what his role is, whether or not. He realized that I better play it this stoically or it's not going to work. And sometimes I don't know.
Yeah.
Let me ask you guys a general question. When it comes to Euro cinema and maybe Spanish film in general, or in particular, I should say, what is it about it that you think really attracts you to it? There's so many different styles, so maybe that's not a fair question, because I think what I've enjoyed the most from the ones that I have seen is, unlike, especially when you come into the 70s, is horror around that time, there was a lot of gore for gore's sake going on. And what I've been able to see, it's been kind of a nice balance where it's needed, it can be gory. Where it's violent, it's violent. But neither of those are necessarily the focus of the films, but I imagine there's probably exceptions to that as well.
Well, you do. Yeah. That's an interesting point though. I hadn't thought about that, but I think that it may be that they consider atmosphere as important as the shock. It's like, if you watch if you watch the films, H.G. Lewis, you know, if you can stand to, if you watch the gore films, you know, the gore is so mechanically and boringly shot that it's obvious, like, it was just for shock value. It's obviously, here we're removing a woman's leg and we're going to just let you watch this, and because we know that it's amazingly shocking to see a woman's leg being removed on, you know, on screen.
And plus, we don't really care that you can tell it's a mannequin.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a high emphasis on, I think, the setting and the atmosphere, the locations of in European cinema. And Rod put a great one time when he, you know, he said that with films outside of the U.S. and Britain, you know, the European films, there's this tendency that they, it's like they looked at all the rules of filmmaking, decide which ones to keep and which ones to throw back. You know?
So. Yeah. And sometimes I feel like the rules they kept were, some of the rules they kept were ones that they kept because they weren't expensive. And some of the ones they threw out were ones that were expensive. But in some cases, I think it's just a question of the culture that the films kind of sprang from. And the thing is, one of the things that I keep learning more and more about is the films that came out of Spain, what kind of seems to differentiate them in a large degree is the first thing that draws you in is that they do seem to be more atmospheric. There does seem to be more emphasis on setting the scene and kind of letting the pace of the film stay at a certain speed so that you get used to being in this world. And sometimes it's you're in the world for a little while before you realize that it's a world where monsters exist or where the supernatural is just part of everyday life or whatever that may be. But a lot of that, the more I go along and kind of study some of these films and do a little bit more reading, one of the things that I'm learning is that the thing that sets the Spanish films apart just might actually be the difference in Spanish culture versus the different countries in Europe. Because Spain, remember, the period that we're talking about was the tail end of a dictatorship. And Spain was very much of itself. It was not until the early to mid-60s that Spain was opened up by the ruler of the country for tourism. So for decades at that point, Spain had kind of been a dictatorship that was locked down. And as a citizen of that country, you didn't move very far outside of it without a very good reason. So in a way, Spain was kind of an island unto itself within Europe. Not that there wasn't trade, not that people didn't occasionally come and go, but those people in that country lived under a dictatorship. And anytime you're under that kind of yoke, you fall back to a lot of particular things that give your life a focus and keep you from feeling quite so oppressed. And one of those things was the Catholic Church. So what you'll find in a lot of Spanish horror that doesn't necessarily crop up, oddly enough, even in Italian horror, is a sense of guilt, a sense of being cut off and feeling kind of conflicted about being cut off, as to whether that's a good or a bad thing. And one of the neater things, and this is now turned up as we when we looked at a seminal Spanish horror film from 1976 called Who Can Kill a Child, one of the things that crops up is that once Spain was opened up in the 60s, the reason it was opened up was purely a monetary reason. Spain was not doing well financially, and so they opened it up a little bit so that they could have tourism back in the country and start making money off people coming in to see the beautiful countryside and their beaches and things of that nature. So one of the things about Spain is that it is a very different culture, and that seeped into those golden age Spanish horror films in some interesting ways. You will see in movies like Candle for the Devil this very interesting mindset in an older generation of Spanish people about the younger generation and their overt sexuality and their going against the wishes of God. You see all these things, even when they don't specifically nail it down and say it is a religious thing, you can see this very conservative mindset that just became the way you survived inside a dictatorship. And so that mindset, although it got loosened in the 60s, and it got loosened enough that they could actually start making horror movies in the very late 60s all the way through the 70s, they still had to be very careful. There's a few very funny things that you'll notice about Spanish horror films. You're going to find very few of these Spanish horror films that are set in Spain. even if they're shot in Spain, the movies are set in, oh, I don't know, Germany or Portugal or somewhere else.
France, yeah.
Right.
England France, sometimes.
Right. And the reasons for that is that you were stepping on toes if you insinuated that these kind of bad, evil things happened in Spain.
Yeah.
So best to just stay away from it. Also, the vast majority of these Spanish horror films and almost all of the Paul Naschy classics from the 70s were shot with it with – there's essentially two different versions of each film. Not that they reshot everything, but the scenes in which there is nudity, that was the export version. That was the version that went to England and the States and to Japan and everywhere else all over the world. And there was the clothed version of the exact same scene that was for Spain. So that conservative aspect of the filmmaking, it kind of seeped into everything, and it kind of takes going through a lot of them and kind of realizing what you're seeing, kind of pulling back and getting a kind of a 10,000 foot view of them all to realize that that may be one of the things that kind of makes them different in a lot of different ways, almost in the DNA. And it comes out in a lot of different ways, and it makes them you can start to pick them out. If you didn't already know it was a Spanish production or a Spanish co-production, some element of it eventually is going to tag that thing in the back of your head once you've seen enough of them. But the like I say, I've always thought it was strange that the Italians didn't have more of that kind of that kind of bizarre dichotomy between the younger and older generations, because once you get into the 70s, that younger generation is starting to actually, you're having a lot more interaction with people from outside the country. You're seeing a lot more what the rest of the world is like. And so there's that push to try to be more, more worldly and therefore more sinful in the ways, in the eyes of a lot of different people.
Yeah.
So a lot of that does crop up. And a lot of people at the time did see the horror movies that were being produced in Spain as part of the kind of, you know, degradation of their culture and watching society slide downhill into hell.
And Chris, you mentioned that you sort of used the term balance, that when you watch these films, you're noticing a kind of a balance between atmosphere and gore. And I think that there's, I think that the Euro horror films of the early 70s and Paul Naschy's films in particular, we've talked a lot about it being that we see a lot of they're kind of that transitional period in horror films. It kind of, I guess, kicked off with, you know, sort of around Night of the Living Dead and the Awful Dr. Orloff and things like that, you know, or both in the States and in Europe, that kind of leaving the classic horror tropes behind and embracing the, you know, the modern, the loosened censorship in the cinema, the more kind of nastier, grittier sort of feel, but, you know,
it became more permissive.
Yeah. And a lot of the best of these films, A Horror Rises from the Tomb is a perfect example, is one that kind of feels like one of those bridge films between, you know, old rotting, you know, fog-filled cemeteries and bats and catacombs, but at the same time, you know, characters, you know, open use of drugs and sex and kind of a viciousness there, you know, that's, you know, not always knowing. Sometimes, you know, films where there's not any real clear-cut hero or villain or that sort of thing, you know, it's not necessarily as clear-cut good versus evil as maybe in the old classic horror films.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's an interesting point. And I think you see that not just in Spanish, but also, like you were saying, in the Italian films and even in the British films. If you think about the Hammer Studios in the 70s, you know, they were moving away from the, like you, as you put it, the foggy graveyards and everything. And suddenly there was, you know, it wasn't just the busty bar wenches. It was busty bar wenches that would lose their tops.
Yeah,
they were just kind of, they still had that foot in the past, but they were taking those tentative steps into, well, and you can argue whether it was for better or for worse. Now you just have, you know, franchises like the Saw films or something here in the States, where it's like, that's where I think it's gross and gore for just for the sake of being gross and gory.
But what's interesting with the Saw films, and I'll admit I'm not a fan of them. I've seen, I think, the first three or four of them. The people who like those movies think they're clever. And the thing is, the way those movies are built, they are clever, but they're clever in a very restrictive way. And there is a certain joy in that that final act thing that happens in Saw movies. But I get that kind of that real joy of surprise from a really well done werewolf makeup and seeing just how well they do an attack on a group of people when the werewolf dives into them and going berserk. It's not the same kind of thing, but it gives me the same kind of pleasure. And so I'll talk bad about a lot of modern horror films all day long. And if you want to, we can start going piece by piece through them. But I don't want to ever feel that I'm going to denigrate the emotion that people get out of those things, because some of the things that really shocked me when I was younger are the things that drew me toward them and therefore made me start delving deeper into the genre and wanting to learn more about it and therefore become a bit more learned, knowledgeable about what I was looking at and learning how to separate the gems from the dross. But the thing is if that is working on an audience member, then that film's functioning the way it's supposed to.
Right. If you want to go back to, I'm sorry, did I cut you
off? No, there you go.
Go back to images that pull you in, draw you in, that are kind of like keystone, touchstone, whatever you talked about, the things that shocked you or the things that drew you in. Yeah. The earliest image in my life that I think kind of was that catalyst there for which way was I going to go? Was I going to be a horror fan or not? Was Barbara Steele's face from Black Sunday with all the holes, you know, the in her face, that iconic image that we always see of her.
Right.
That film actually played on. I saw that film on TV when I was really, really young, and I don't remember if it played on the afternoon movie or if it actually might have played on Creature Feature. But I just remember that, you know, I'd already seen horror movies. I mean, as far as the monster movies, I love the monsters. You know, I was never terrified of the monsters. They were all my friends, you know, that this was the first film that showed an image to me that was, you know, this whole pounding this mask of nails onto this woman's face. And then that you know, that look in her eyes and that face with all those holes in it was an image that was striking and visceral. But I was fascinated by it. You know, I always feel like there's moments in people's lives when they're young that kind of determine whether they know it at the time or not. If they are going to go deeper into this and become fascinated by being frightened or fascinated by being thrilled or fascinating by horror, or they become those people that you talk to now who are like, no, I don't do the horror films. I don't do, you know, which we know a lot of those people, you know, who are just like, you know, no, I'm just, you know, I can't do it. I just don't do the horror films. Can't get it, you know, and that's fine. But I think that there are those moments where you go one way or the other when you're too young to even realize you're going to do that. And I think that's one of those moments for me. And it's interesting that that was a Euro horror film. Even that young age, I had no idea, but I was probably being marked right there to be a future Euro horror fan, you know.
Marked by the mask of Satan.
Marked by the mask of Satan, that's right.
Well, I myself, I think I remember seeing some horror films when I was younger, just like you, Troy, the things that would kind of come on the local UHF station in really inopportune times.
Yeah.
But they were typically more in the way of American horror or drama. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember the UHF had like a back to back of like Extremities and the Burning Bed.
Oh, wow. Which,
on a Sunday afternoon, you know. So.
That's not after viewing.
No, not at all. And I think there was even a third one that followed it that was just the same, you know, of the same ilk. And I remember being kind of almost pushed away by it when I was younger. And it hasn't been until recently that I've kind of dipped my toe back into the horror genre and trying to find films that I enjoy. And, you know, the European stuff seems to be the bulk of it, whether it be Hammer, whether it be Nashi, whether it be, Bickett, you know, Italian or whatever. But, you know, there's a lot that I enjoy, and there are stuff that, and this is where the podcasts come in great, is I can hear the synopsis, I can hear about it and go, nope, that one's not for me.
Yeah. Well, you have to be able to realize that there are roads that you don't necessarily care to go down. And mm-hmm. The thing is, these days we swim in the greatest movie fan waters that have ever existed. You have got to decide which direction to swim, and you may only want to swim in a particular direction for a little while and then go in another direction. But the joy is that we're no longer sitting around all looking at a half empty glass. Yeah. We're in a pool.
Yeah.
We can see this stuff. It is out there. There are ways to see this stuff. If you can learn about it, there's a way to track that sucker down. And even if it looks like crap, at least experience it in one way or another. So one of the things about that I've been in a discussion with different people about over time is that not just when you're young, but now as an adult, you have to make conscious choices about whether or not you're going to spend some time getting to know this filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And you have to have some information in front of you before you, quote unquote, waste your time. And if we can do that for some people, if we can point them towards something where they listen to us talk about it and they may enjoy us talking about it, but they've decided I don't necessarily want to see the movies, that's fine too. We had a recent person write into the NashyCast and explain that he's listened to all of our shows and has yet to ever watch a Paul Nashy film.
Which I still have a hard time getting my mind around. I mean, that's a real nice compliment, obviously. Yeah. But it's very strange.
it's very strange because, I mean, these shows are, you know, hour and a half to 2.5 hour long, you know, advertisements for the movie we're talking about, essentially. And this guy just like, I just really like listening to you guys.
It's like, man, I've got an awesome shelf full of books on the Rolling Stones, but I've never listened to a single album. You know? I mean, and I'm not making fun of the guys. It's just funny. But like you said, it's what you choose, how you choose to get into it. You know, but that is interesting. I found that really fascinating.
The thing is, if you want to delve into Spanish horror, it doesn't just have to be Paul Nashy. You can cut the Paul Nashy with a whole lot of other filmmakers. There's a lot of very interesting stuff out there. The golden age of Spanish horror lasted from about 1968 to about 1977, 1978. So it's 9 or 10 years, but packed in there are dozens and dozens of amazing movies. And I'd like to say I've seen them all, but to be honest, there are still a few that have escaped my view as well. I just recently caught up with a little film called Diabolical Shudder that ain't great, but it wasn't horrible either. And I had heard it was horrible, so I was expecting the worst and kind of enjoyed it. So, you know, that's another one off the checklist. It's not anything I'm going to recommend to people, especially not people who haven't delved into the genre very heavily, but I also just last night rewatched Candle for the Devil because there's a really good Blu-ray of that out. And the more I see that movie, the more I think of it as kind of a quintessential early 70s Spanish horror film because it really sinks itself very deeply into the way the Spanish culture was at the time. And the horror grows out of that dichotomy between opening the country up and letting, you know, an entire generation that has been cut off from the outside world for a long time see what the rest of the world has advanced to. And it's really, really quite neat. There's a lot of really good stuff there. I mean, if you want a list of other Spanish horror films to see, let me highly recommend The Living Dead at Manchester Morgue.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Which is a phenomenal movie. We did a podcast on that one, and it is basically the Spanish color answer to Night of the Living Dead, done about 7 years after the fact. And it's phenomenal.
Yeah. Oh, Horror Express. You got to see Horror Express.
And that's an easy fit because if you're a Hammer fan, it's got Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, along with you know.
If you love Telly Savalas like I do.
Yeah, that's one we've watched. I've watched that one a couple times.
Oh, good, good. Okay, well that's a classic.
Well, the man who made Horror Express also made Candle for the Devil, so you can already see the line starting to form. Yeah. You can see how these things fit together. And God, what are some of the we just recently covered Lorelei's Grasp, which is an amazing little film, but it's another one of those that'll be kind of harder to get your hands on.
Yeah, I heard that your episode on that one, and I did start digging around, and yep, I came up empty on it.
Now, a name that hasn't come up, I don't believe at all yet, is Jess Franco. So have you tried any Franco yet?
I'm not sure.
And are you not even sure if you want to? You may not want to after what you hear people talk about it, but
depending on what your entry point is, you may not want to.
Because the thing about it is even though yes, it's Spanish film, it's almost like he's on his own track in a lot of ways. Well, even though there are some actors who spill over, and we've covered some Franco films on our Beyond Nashy, it's almost like when you're talking about these, you know, Klimovsky and you know, and D'Osorio and Nashi, you know, it's like, say again, it's almost like,
and even Jose LaRoz.
Yeah. It's even like Franco's, it's almost like Franco's just kind of his in on his own separate track there.
And Franco kind of really, Franco really is kind of his own separate track for a very specific reason. He's a Spanish filmmaker, but he wanted to make horror films. So he left Spain in the early 60s. And so his early work through the mid to late 60s were done in Spain. I mean, I'm sorry, they weren't done in Spain. They were mostly done in France and a few other countries. And then when things got loosened up, he did come back to Spain and start making films there as well. But dipping your toes into Franco is a very, very it's a risky proposition.
Because it's like dipping your toes in an ocean. You know?
Yeah.
some directors may be like dipping your toes in a pool or a lake. With Franco, it's more like the Pacific Ocean or something. I mean, it's like there is so much.
There are hundreds. Of it.
And I would say, Rod, might agree with me on this. Is if I would say that you probably shouldn't, if you choose to delve into Franco, you should not base your opinion on him off just a couple of films. I mean, if you want to really, unless you just can't go any further, but in seriousness, really, I mean, I think you probably need to watch a good 10 or so of his films, and probably a couple from the 60s, 70s, even 80s. I mean, you probably need to watch a handful before you really can start to get a sense of
And the good news about Franco is that more and more of his films are available and easy to see. And there's a really quick reference that I have, which is I always point people toward his very first horror film, The Awful Dr. Orloff.
That is, that's a really good one.
And the reason I point you toward The Awful Dr. Orloff is that it's 1962. It feels a lot like someone wanted to make a universal horror film, but sex it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. With just an extra little bit of violence. And it's a really atmospheric film. It's shot in black and white. It's beautiful to see, and it's very effective. It is a great little bridge film, so that if you start with that one, you will at least know, well, not everything Franco made is going to piss me off.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah.
And then you can delve into a couple. I would go to The Diabolical Dr. Z, which he made a couple of years later, which is also very, very interesting and also quite linear. Which is not always true of the 70s output. There's a lot of great stuff in the 70s. There's some hit or miss stuff. And what's terrifying about Franco is that when I say hit or miss, that could be within the same movie and within the same scene.
Yeah.
So there's so many Franco movies out there. And I wasted a lot of years hating Jess Franco with a blood red passion.
Same here.
And then there came a point when I watched another one of his movies, and suddenly something clicked in my brain, and it all changed. Now, that I'm never going to say that I've enjoyed every Jess Franco movie I've ever seen, but once you get on his wavelength, and there are better and worse ways to do that, you see what he's after. And the thing is, one of the great things about Jess Franco is that if you ever read about him and you hear any interviews with him, the guy's just like us.
Oh, you love the guy. He seems like a great guy.
Yeah, I mean, he's a comic book nerd and a pulp story fanatic, and he loved fantasy stories. Mm-hmm. And this was the kind of stuff that he grew up on, and it's the kind of stuff he really enjoyed for himself. And so, when you realize that that's where a lot of this stuff stems from, once you get to a movie like some of his cool little spy spoofs in the late 60s, like Lucky the Inscrutable. Mm-hmm. You're just laughing your butt off because you're getting some of the references that you kind of have to be a kind of pulp geek to get. There's all this stuff that's layered within not all of his movies, but some of them that are just a joy. And then there are ones that are simply, you know, slow, boring scenes of women writhing on beds. That's part of what you're going to see.
Was that supposed to be a downside, or
you wouldn't think so.
Franco is much. Yes, Franco has an amazing ability to sometimes make the erotic really unerotic, and what should be erotic not pretty.
If there is a way to, there are a number of Franco films that are considered touchstones and kind of the movies that just Franco fanatics are supposed to worship, and I don't like them. Mm. I like a lot of his movies, but I am not a fan of Female Vampire, although I do like the porno version, not for the right reasons. I'm not a big fan of Succubus, which is another one, which is one from 1969. I think these films that I'm naming are ones that are considered. Vampire's Lesbos is another one. It's these are considered like his really amazing, almost art films, and they bore me to death. Because I'll sit and kind of really enjoy watching a really gorgeous naked woman writhe around on a bed as if she's masturbating for a while. But after 20 minutes of it, I'm ready for the movie.
Gotcha.
And, you know, that's really what starts off as erotic, which is this woman almost licking a bedpost until the veneer is going to come off of it, suddenly becomes something you don't care about anymore, yeah. And you're reaching for the fast forward button. Now, for some people, it may be different. For me, I like my nudity to have a point, and that came out wrong. Okay, I'm going to back off that now, and let Troy speak, and maybe he'll embarrass himself.
What to say? Well, no, I mean, I think you covered it very well about the Franco again. That's mentioning Awful Dr. Orloff. I mean, I would probably like say Awful Dr. Orloff and Werewolf Shadow would probably the two most important films really in the classic age of Spanish horror. You know, because I think
Awful, that's a bold statement.
Because I think Awful Dr. Orloff really kind of kicked it off. I'm not saying it's the first one, but it was. Very, very early enough to be considered one of the first, and then Werewolf Shadow is the one that had the international breakthrough.
Yeah,
there's plenty of other films I'm sure you could put around. You know, those. I mean, obviously, The Tombs of the Blind Dead is very important too. I mean, there's other ones too, but I'm just saying if you have to really boil it down to, you know, if you want to list it and say like, okay, let's start with the two keystone. Those to me are the touchstones. Are the Awful Dr. Orloff and Werewolf Shadow.
Well, those are fine choices. I agree with you. The thing is, the quote unquote golden age of Spanish horror that supposedly started in 1968. With Mark of the Werewolf. The two films in 68 that kind of mark the beginning of quote unquote the golden age are not they're not as popular as Werewolf Shadow. I'll give you that.
Right.
But they're The House That Screamed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Mark of the Werewolf, which was released over here as Frankenstein's Bloody Terror, those two movies were successful,
mm-hmm.
and they were definitely Spanish productions. And so the fact that those were as successful as they were is what kind of spurred producers to not be afraid to make these kind of movies and try to export them. And by 1972, which is when how many movies did Nashi get out in 72? Was it two or three?
Boy, I would say at least three.
Because Horror Rises was one of them.
Yeah, yeah. 72 and 73 were like his peak years. I mean,
yeah, where he produced about five or six movies in those 2 years, and that's just
they were pretty much all, for the most part, getting U.S. distribution of some kind, being picked up by distributors. Christopher? Do you know the story behind Frankenstein's Bloody Terror? Why it's called that? Have you heard this tale?
I don't think so.
It's just a great example of, you know, I love drive-in culture and we're hearing the history of drive-in cultures. And one of the great things about the Frankenstein's Bloody Terror DVD has a commentary by Sam Sherman, right? Yeah, Sherman. Sam Sherman's audio commentaries are fantastic because they serve as a great comprehensive like history overview of what the drive-in exploitation market was like. And he was the one who brought Mark of the Wolfman over to show on US screens. But what had happened was he had promised his distributors a Frankenstein movie. And I think that it was one that was being done by Al Adamson, I believe, if I'm right about that. I think it was one that was supposed to be delivered to him by Al Adamson. And it, you know, no surprise when you know Al Adamson, you know, there were difficulties with it. It never got finished. He didn't have the film and his distributors had been promised a Frankenstein movie. So he found this film, Mark of the Wolfman, that had been made by this guy, Paul Nashi, and he screened it and thought it was, you know, had a lot of merit to it. He did some editing on it. And from his point of view, a lot of the edits he made were kind of understandable story-wise stuff. Now, you know, I prefer the full version, but I can see why he made some of the edits he did. But anyway, what he did was he decided to sort of shoehorn it into trying to pass it off as a Frankenstein movie, even though there's no Dr. Frankenstein and there's no Frankenstein monster. And so he basically inserted this prologue that explains that the family of Frankenstein, you know, in order to escape being pursued, you know, being hounded by angry villagers or whatever, you know, moved to another country and changed their name to Wolf. and that they somehow through their experiments encountered contracted some sort of werewolf curse, and so all this is told you before the opening credits, so that's supposed to make you feel okay about the fact that you're not going to see Frankenstein or and it even has a little cartoon drawing of a Frankenstein head monster turning into a werewolf. And so
that is awesome.
I just love stories like that. That's
because a producer
was expecting
had promised a Frankenstein movie to his distributors and
no, they're Frankensteins, it's just witness protection.
what kills me is if you once you see Mark of the Werewolf, once you see the movie, you just want to scream because it's got werewolves and vampires. What? How could you name the movie the one big
creature that's not in
it? Well, there you again. Here, then you suddenly have little old me turning on the TV to see a movie called Frankenstein's Bloody Terror and watching the last half hour and thinking, man, this is awesome. Werewolves, vampires. Okay, when's the Frankenstein monster going to show up? And
oh man, it's a great movie, but the fact that it's still best known under that freaking weird title.
Well, I definitely have a lot of information and a lot of stuff to go on here, and hopefully the listeners have a little bit more too. I think, you know, I've kept you guys now for a good hour and a half of your evening.
Oh, we've had a great time, man. We appreciate you. Appreciate you thinking of inviting us onto your show, and we've had a great time talking to you. And I'll say too, there's a book by Nicholas Schlegel that's called, you may be able to remember, Sex, Sadism,
and, oh, darn it.
Just remember, Google sex sadism in Spanish cinema.
Sex, comma, sadism.
Yes.
Once you weed through all the images, you're not going to want to look at.
Yeah, maybe want to throw in book or something. Yeah, into that.
Nicholas Schlegel. Anyway, yeah, so it's a really good book on Spanish horror that came out about a year or so ago. It's not necessarily a comprehensive listing, but he definitely gives a lot. He does a real lot of good write-ups about what he considers the films that are essential viewing of Spanish cinema. Yeah. So it's good reading. You should check it out if you get a chance.
There, I did a review of it on my blog. If you go to my blog and use the tags, the subject tags at the bottom, just choose books and scroll down probably a year and you'll find it. And
Don't put sex and sadism or you'll get Rod's writings on things you don't want to know about.
Yeah, yeah. There are photographs out there that need not be seen. So.
Well, I suppose that's as good a segue as anyway. So why don't you guys kind of let us know where we can find everything, where we can find the Bloody Pit and the Ashy Cast and all other good stuff.
Rod,
like I say, everything springs from the blog. The blog is the Bloody Pit of Rod. On that, you'll find a direct link to the Ashy Cast. And actually, there's a player right there where you can play any of the last four episodes, or you can just go over and pull the episodes down either through iTunes or straight off the page. And there's also the other podcast that we do called The Bloody Pit, which is me and a revolving group of people that talk about just whatever film that we feel like talking about. I'm getting very proud of The Bloody Pit because. It was the podcast I decided to do that allowed me to talk about something other than Spanish horror and Paul Naschy. And boy, have we roamed all over the place. Troy and I have been for the past couple of years been doing a series, basically two different little broken up series where we look at different Toho monster movies on that podcast.
Nice. Yeah, I've been enjoying those. Those are great.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've been having a good time. The latest one is Destroy All Monsters, and I really love covering these films because it allows me to kind of play the neophyte to Troy's scholar, and I'm able to learn a lot about these movies as we go along, not just through my own research, but because he's been a big fan of them for so long and has studied them in so many different ways and done so much reading on the subjects that it's just a joy to sit there and kind of absorb the stuff. But also been doing a lengthy series, a kind of broken up series on the Italian filmmaker Antonio Margheriti with another friend of ours, John Hudson. And we're actually later this month going to get back to that, covering a film called Ark of the Sun God, which as you...
Oh, I've got that one.
Hey,
awesome. You're actually going to cover a film I own.
Yeah, I think that one's ended up on a number of different cheap DVDs over the years, and it's actually a blast. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, oh, it is. Oh, well, funny story how I ended up with it. We went to – do you guys have Half Price Books down in around you?
Up in Kentucky, there are a few. I know there's one in Bowling.
Okay.
Yeah.
It used bookstore. But they also carry, you know, if you want VHS or DVDs, you can find them there too. Well, they had a big, like, warehouse sale kind of thing where they went to one of the local convention centers and they just, all their overstock and everything. And they had DVDs and books and all that good stuff. And, we'll go up and we'll poke around. Well, I'm poking around. I'm looking around. I find this Ark of the Sun God, but it's an Italian DVD. And I'm thinking, well, and it was only like, you know, $2. I'm thinking, well, I'm going to save someone the frustration of them not being able to put it in their player and have it work, because I had the region free player.
There you go.
So I did it as a favor.
I'm wondering if it's the if somehow you got the Italian disc. I'm wondering if it has the English dub on it.
I'm trying to remember if it had the dub. I know it's got English subtitles, and I'm trying to remember if it has a dub, and I don't know.
Well then you're fine. Yeah. The English dub is quite good. It was still the early 80s, and so there was really high quality control in the dubbing being done over there at that time. So it's actually really well done. So,
all right, well, cool. I'll have to check it out before you guys get up to that one. I'll have to watch it again. I'll look into it.
I just want to say real quick, also should mention that for people who use Facebook, there is a NashiCast page on Facebook
that you can
go to as well. And you can there. We always post whenever there's new NashiCast or Bloody Pit episodes always come up on the NashiCast page. So.
Plus, if there's any information about upcoming DVD releases or different books coming out or anything like that, we try to post that information up as well.
Speaking of which, we don't have an exact release date, but we do in September. Vinegar Syndrome is going to be doing Count Dracula's Great Love, a Blu-ray. That's the next important Paul Naschy Blu-ray release. And that's a film that's, I call it one of the most beautiful of his films to look at. It's also one of the most confounding story-wise, but it's one that I always have always find very entertaining. I really like it, even though it has a lot of problems. It's got some amazing imagery in there. So Count Dracula's Great Love, be watching for the Vinegar Syndrome Blu-ray coming out soon.
Yeah.
Sweet. All right, well, I guess if you want to find us, the Time Shifters podcast, well, obviously you found us, you're listening. But yeah, you can find us on iTunes or go to timeshifterspodcast.com. And we do also have a Facebook page as well. So once again, Rod and Troy, thank you very much for joining me. And kind of as we called it, Spanish Horror 101. I've got a lot of information to kind of digest. And like I said, just a little bit more of a focus on what to look for and kind of and get me a little deeper into this really fun genre.
Well, what can we say? We're happy to be enabling the corrupting force.
the corrupting force, yes.
Yeah.
And thank you very much. Thank you very much for asking us.
Yeah,
we were glad to
time.
Do it.
Good time.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Hopefully we'll see each other at some future Monster Bash again.
Oh, absolutely. I hope so.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.